Gathered here to share in the silence in a very noisy world. And in this sanctuary, we may not hear the noise of the world from the outside, though we have heard a few airplanes, trains, and traffic of various sorts. Woodpeckers and other more beautiful sounds. That's an interpretation. But probably the biggest noise that we hear is in our own heads. And even though we've traveled, most of us have traveled at least 5 hours, whether due to traffic or distance, to get here. And yet, it follows us, doesn't it? Can't run away from it. You sit down and then there it goes, relentless, inexhaustible thought processes. But we are fortunate because we have a path, we have a methodology, a teaching, instructions, a map, the faculties, enough presence of mind, trust, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and the wisdom to come and be here, to work with these seemingly Niagara-sized obstructions. And they don't disappear just like that. It takes a lot of endurance, patience, courage, and more trust, and more wisdom, perseverance of a very high degree, a commitment to keep working with this, to keep clearing the path, clearing the mind, so that we can reach some state of, some degree of relief, of peace, relaxation in the heart, and interior happiness that will be resilient in the face of the onslaught of thoughts that will still come, or stress that will still appear, or obstructions that will land and return and assault us, assault the mind. So at the end of the first day of real practice, it's good to review and see, how do we feel? What's the condition of the heart in this moment? We know the condition of the heart at work, in our family situations, when we're in traffic, when we're walking in the woods. What's the situation of the heart here in this beautiful sanctuary after practicing this insight meditation or concentration meditation for several intensive hours, really dedicated practice? How do we feel? We feel confident, not confident, discouraged, not discouraged, happy, medium, happy, tired, energized, curious, bored. What are we feeling? And the reason that we're investigating what we're feeling is not just a casual, like when you check the weather on the Weather Channel, but because it's really important for us to assess the result of our efforts and to make adjustments. The weather outside of us we have no control over, unless you go to Mexico during the winter. We have that way of getting out of it. But to work with the weather in the mind, we do have tools. And it's good to make an assessment and then take responsibility. And in order to do that, we have to be familiar with what we're working with here. So, just to review quickly, there are five main obstructions that we all face. They're called the hindrances. It's actually a good thing that they have a name, and then we can know that they're not personal. Five hindrances. Everybody has them. Most every human being has greed, has ill will, experiences anxiety, worry, and restlessness, boredom, dullness of mind, and doubt. And it's good, just like when we have a physical illness, we like to go to a clinic or a physician and put a name to it. Somehow, when it's packaged, we can get our minds around it. Then we get the right medicine. And it can be limiting as well, because it could be a cluster of illnesses. But if there's one thing that we can get a grasp on and apply the right medicine, at least we know what we're working with. It's a similar thing with our mental illness. And notice if there's any ruffled feathers when I say that we're mentally ill. We are. We're mentally unwell, unsettled, uncomposed, discontented, dissatisfied. Well, some of you might say, no, I am not. I'm perfectly happy. Okay, let's wait till tomorrow and see. A few more days of practice, and there's bound to be suffering that comes up, and it's important to see what form it takes. So once we know the form it takes, then we can contemplate it more readily. Contemplating greed, knowing greed is greed, knowing ill will is ill will, knowing anxiety, worry, restlessness for what they are, knowing sloth and torpor for what it is, knowing doubt, because each one has a slightly different flavor, and they all have slightly different antidote. What is greed? What does it feel like? Greed in the mind is desire for something, be it food or some beautiful mind state, But when we feel strong urges of greed in the body or in the mind, it's good to try to note the physical sensation that goes along with that. Is there a tension anywhere in the body? Just to stop and be aware of it. And then to be able to identify the mind state itself. With every one of the hindrances, it's important for us to know how they arise, what are the conditions that bring them up, what's at the root, what's the origin of the suffering. Because each of these are a form of dukkha, aren't they? And then to notice, how did this come to be? That's the first thing. It's usually because we haven't been paying close enough attention and haven't been mindful enough, and then suddenly we're fantasizing about lunch or breakfast tomorrow because we're hungry. And then as soon as we can catch it and identify it, that gives us a vantage, gives us a possibility to see the condition for what it is and remove it. And the object of the whole practice is not just to notice that we feel greedy. Because if we sit and notice that we feel greedy, but we don't try to somehow either let the greed fall away or remove it more proactively, then it might just overwhelm the mind. And then mindfulness is no longer moves the mind in the direction of nibbana. Then the greed becomes an obstruction. But if we use greed as an object of our meditation, by knowing it, being aware of it, removing it, and then being present for the next mind moment, then that paves the path towards nibbana. That inclines the mind towards freedom from greed. When we know greed, we can also know the absence of greed. We know it as a hindrance, and we let it go. Then we know how to prevent another moment of greed by seeing the moment of the greedy mind state and not owning it or not being self-disparaging, oh, there I am, a greedy person. Then we don't fall into another form of attachment, which is identification with self, with some being that is greedy, which is in itself another more dangerous obstacle. With every one of these, with ill will, noticing how it arises, removing it, and preventing it from arising again. These are the three modes of activity that are essential for us to enable mindfulness, to enable right effort, to enable the development of concentration, and to grow the conditions in the mind for wisdom to arise. The same is true for restlessness or worry. The same is true for boredom. Maybe now at the end of the day, quiet, feeling tired, Dhamma talk, it's kind of falling over, the eyes are closing, the lids are heavy, and we feel sleepy. Or doubt, like I am not sure about this. This isn't really what I came here for. I just want to practice, leave me alone. Whatever, or that could be also kind of aversion to having to listen to somebody say anything. The real practice is just silence. And this is the thinking mind and the greedy or ill-tempered, averse, judging, doubting, bored, etc. But when mindfulness touches the mind state as an object of attention, and we use appropriate attention, ardent attention, vigilant attention, like continuous, then it doesn't take us over. Then we're not identifying with any person. We're just observing the object. We're observing the mind state and seeing the weather pattern arise, be sustained for a few moments, and then noticed in the strong spotlight, the strong radar of Dhamma awareness, it falls away, dissipates, and we come to the next moment, which may have a completely different flavor. We don't become burdened, hindered by these different states of mind, and we can apply the antidotes, investigating, bringing up loving kindness in the face of aversion, applying greater effort to concentrate the mind, and with boredom sometimes we have to change postures or use a different form of practice, like scanning the body, going to the physical aspects of the body, doing walking meditation. With doubt, we can do investigation. With all of the hindrances, we can investigate what is it. Just like an anthropologist that digs, go behind the feeling of wanting, behind the feeling of agitation, peel it away and investigate. What is it? What is it? Taste it. Examine it closely. Feel it at its root. Not feeling the effects of it, but feel it as sensation in the body or as tightness in the breath or as an agitated breath, a pounding of the breath, piercing, burning. You feel the greediness in the breath itself. Does it become narrow? With anger we can feel heat. With fear, there can be a contraction. There can be a tightening of the breath, even a choking feeling. Sometimes, when we're really upset, I've often told people, I experience it myself, when if we cry, if you feel very sad and you start to weep, it's impossible to breathe and weep at the same time. Try it. Test it. Start gulping. You're gasping for breath. There's weeping. And these are really wonderful clues. When we're mindful and fully aware of our suffering, not in a personal way, but just in a more examining, like a doctor. What happens when we go to a doctor and the stethoscope is applied to the heart? Do you ever feel your heart start beating a little faster than you think that you're going to get the high blood pressure analysis? But actually, you don't think you have high blood pressure. But in that moment, your pressure could go up. just because you're being examined. But if we are examining our own experience, we can use the inner stethoscope to see what's the state of the heart in the face of this hindrance. Are we ducking? Are we cowering? Are we contracting? Are we expanding? Is there joy? Is there a feeling of beauty and peace? Or is there a trembling, a shaking? Notice that one of the benefits we read about was to have a mind that doesn't tremble, unshaken heart. This is one of the benefits of practice, is to develop an unshakable heart. Then what we do when we see the hindrances for what they are and know the danger of them, then we're developing the path just as if we were to free ourselves from bondage. In fact, the freedom from the hindrances is what creates our ability, enables us to walk the path more freely, with more strength, with fearlessness, with non-greed, with non-ill will, with stability, security, not anxiety and trepidation. We can walk the path with energy and wakefulness rather than exhaustion and discouragement. Can't do this anymore. No. We bring up in ourselves a reservoir of energy. And doubt is the most disabling hindrance of all. It is said that freedom from the hindrances is like being free from debt, disease, imprisonment, slavery, and danger. That's what the freedom from the hindrances is. Freedom from the hindrances means that the mind is able to rest in the present moment and not be jumping into the past and the future or ruminating in the here and now about what can I get. It's just present. Just to be with things exactly as they are. That's contentment. That's peace. That's a fullness of full-bodied experience. It's a wakefulness. It's lack of being pulled apart by different desires or attention being distracted in different directions. And that's what we need to walk this path. That's what we need just to take one breath at a time properly. So who's been breathing? How have we been breathing all these years? As alms mendicants, just because we've, so to speak, left the world, it doesn't mean that we've left hindrances behind. In fact, the hindrances seem to get accelerated in monastic life just the way they do on retreat. You come on retreat and you suddenly find that there's a Niagara of hindrances. There's this incredible wave of oversized hindrances, whereas before we were completely balanced people. So how come when we come here into this beautiful place, we feel, how did I get like this? In monastic life, it's the same way. We think that we've left the world at the gate, but it follows us right through the gate. So when we stand for alms, and lately we've taken up this practice of standing for alms in our local market, farmers market, just imagine dressed like this and you've got an alms bowl and you're standing between these stalls where they're selling bags and bottles of jam, maple syrup, cookies and bread. People are walking their dogs and meeting up with the locals, riding their bicycles, checking out the local vegetables, selling their produce, just going for a walk on a sunny Saturday morning. There's a very interesting guy who's growing mushrooms. Yeah, there's a lot of interest in the mushroom man. And then there are these nuns. Some people try to put money in our bowls, but we don't accept money. And that's a real game stopper right there. Because what do you mean? What do you do? What are you collecting? We're collecting food. Food? For who? For us. We only eat what people give us. Oh. Some people say, good to know. And then they walk away. But actually, the first time that happened, a few minutes later, this gentleman came back with some lovely offerings. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you what other people are experiencing. What are we experiencing? It never ceases to amaze me what the process involves of, first of all, standing there for till the market hots up. First, everyone's just kind of arriving and getting used to the ambiance, and before they even notice us. And then they've circled a few times, and then finally they think, well, we better find out what this is. And they have the courage to come and ask. And then they ask, and meanwhile, your feet feel, get very sore feet, circulation's not that good, start feeling a little wobbly. The bowl is heavy, my shoulders are slumped, it's hot, or we're in the sun. And it's just can you be mindful, can you observe the bowl, can you bring your mind to emptiness, can you not notice the tiredness, discomfort, the heat, all these things. And the hindrance is, Mara is always ready to jump in and strangle you if you're not mindful. And so it's a constant practice of bringing one's attention back to the empty bowl, to the people walking by, feeling compassion. There's a lot of old people. You see people in poor health, people who are very obese, people who are alone, lonely, sad, looking for conversation, companionship. So many things that one can read in people's faces. It's the whole stream of life going by. And then it's one's own mind trying to meet that with an open heart and skillful presence, rather than, is anyone going to ever come and put something in our bowls? As soon as that thought comes, to just not follow it, but come back to just being with what's happening. And then suddenly the bowl does start to get filled. People bring different kinds of offerings to the point where we have to have a bag on the ground into which to empty the offerings. And by the time we're finished with our alms round, we have more food than we can eat. We've never been disappointed. But I want to relay one particular incident that happened last week. This woman was walking past with, she was quite heavy, and she was going from vendor to vendor, and I thought, well, there's going to be a lot of food for her to munch on. She's pretty heavy. And I felt for her, so I felt compassion. Then there was 5 little kids following her, all different sizes, all different races. And I thought, these kids must be adopted. This is the foster mother. And she was buying food for all of them, not for herself, which is why she had so much food. She had a lot of bags full of food. And then after she finished shopping, she was handing them little tidbits to eat, and then she passed by us, and she looked at us, and at first I thought she was going to be annoyed, because, but then she said, "What are you collecting?" And we said, "Food." And she said, "Food? Who's going to eat it?" Again, "We are." "Oh!" And she pulled out this giant brick and said, "I give you my bread," with a huge grin on her face. It was the most amazing thing. It was the last person I expected to come towards us with an offering. And she gave us this massive, beautiful, kind of specialized bread. There was so much love with which it came. The process of presenting oneself helpless, relying on the kindness of others, and practicing mindfulness with faith, with patience, and with the willingness to receive whatever comes, it's really miraculous what you get. And I'm telling you this as a way of trying to encourage you with the hindrances. No matter how much the hindrances keep attacking the mind, never be discouraged. Don't let discouragement turn into another hindrance. Know that every new moment there's an opportunity to know the hindrance exactly for what it is and come back to that state of offering your attention and presence to this moment to receive the beauty that will come, to receive the kindness and gifts that will come. And they will not come as long as our mind is assailed by hindrances. That's the secret. I'm telling you this because I've learned this through, not just through the alms round, but in a very big way through the alms round. Why would people who are not Buddhists, who don't know anything about what we're doing, come towards us and feed us when they're just there for a little Saturday morning stroll? They've got a few extra coins. They probably don't have a lot of time or a lot of interest. But there's something that touches them when they see the faith with which we're standing there. There's something that touches their hearts and opens their hearts. And doubt is the biggest enemy of all. If we can trust this practice, then our ability to trust the present moment will yield great bread, delicious bread, that will nurture the next breath, the next step in front of us, and free us from our greed, our selfishness, our self-concern, our fear, worry. Now, there are two of us, how are we going to get two meals? Before I was training nuns, I was just one nun. And there's another one back at the monastery. How are three of us going to be fed? And it just keeps happening. There's some magnificent chemistry. If we can just surrender ourselves to the process and stop identifying with the poisons of the ego and these hindrances that have been taking our minds in a direction that does not yield freedom. It's dangerous. It's a kind of bondage. Like, the world is always posting notes in front of us. Eat me. Get this. Want this. Have this. Buy
buy me, buy this. Own a new one, another one. Have more. Have a better variety. And we keep falling for all that. Over and over again. Even as Dhamma practitioners. The level of care, renunciation, effort, wisdom, mindfulness, perspicacity, commitment that we need, fearlessness to really walk this path, it's pretty high. The stakes are high, and we need to grow our ability to meet those stakes with the tools the Buddha has given us. Otherwise, we're just going to end up settling for mediocrity. And when we get sick, old, when we're alone, when we're depressed, when we feel miserable, discouraged, overwhelmed, when we're made redundant, when something happens that we can't deal with, how are we going to get ourselves out of that? What if the doctor doesn't have a cure? How will we heal our minds? The body is incurable, because it's headed for deterioration, dust, decay. That's where the body's going. But the mind can head for freedom. The mind can be freed. And this is an important distinction to come to. The real medicine that we want is not the cure of the body, but that's really longing for. Let us gratify this bodily formation. And if we can free the mind from that particular obsession, let us gratify. The five senses, the untrained mind. Then we will be true spiritual warriors, able to win back the boundaries of our hearts. Able to accomplish this way and free ourselves completely. So I offer you this bread for today.
Annamayam Yamakataya Sadhukaram Tadamase.
Now let's express our approval of this Dhamma teaching.